KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Robert Burton is a San Francisco neurologist and author who has written a book all about believing you are right, even if you aren't. His newest book is called On Being Certain, and he joins us on Forum with your calls and emails after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this morning's Forum. Robert Burton describes himself as a neurologist with a novelist sensibility, a regular columnist with Salon.com and former chief of neurology at UCSF's Mount Zion Hospital in San Francisco and associate chief of the Department of Neurosciences. He is also the author of Doc in a Box and Cellmates, and his latest book is called On Being Certain, Believing You Are Right, Even When You're Not. Robert Burton joins us for this Forum Hour, and good to see you. Welcome.
Hi, Michael.
Well, this is all about feeling of knowing, or as opposed to knowing. Even when it's contrary, even when there's no evidence, people feel that they know and therefore they're right, and that certainty is maybe nothing more than a mental sensation, we learn from your book.
Right.
Now, that's right. Kind of extraordinary, because it suggests that people, in fact, not only does it suggest, but you give ample evidence that even in the wake of evidence contrary to the fact, for example, let's talk about the Challenger study, because it's so fascinating to people.
Right.
106 people wrote down right after the Challenger exploded what they felt, what they saw, where they were, and so forth. 2.5 years later, went back and read those things after saying where they thought they were from memory and what they thought they were experiencing from memory. And in many cases, that there was no jibing at all between what they had written. And in at least one case, a guy refused to believe it was his handwriting.
Right. He actually said, "That's my handwriting, but that's not what happened." And that's actually what started me. I think I mentioned that to you a few years ago, that particular study.
When you were last back on Forum, yeah.
Yeah. And at the time I talked to you about it, I really didn't understand what it was about. I understood there was something wrong with how you could look at that. And I figured it must be psychological at the time, some cognitive dissonance. But it sort of prompted me to think, well, maybe it isn't, because it isn't a high ego thing to admit you're wrong when you have your handwriting there saying, this is where I was, and then 2.5 years later, you say that's not where I was. It would be easy to admit, oh, I made a mistake. But no, it actually felt as if the old false memory was correct. I mean, the new false memory is correct.
Well, you even have a case history of a woman in here who feels that she's dead.
Right.
They show her she has a heartbeat, she has a pulse. It doesn't matter. She still feels that she's dead, so she believes that she's dead.
Right. And actually, it's fascinating because it's a syndrome which has been described as very rare, but sometimes with psychiatric disease, but with neurologic disease, in which you go from a situation where you're obviously alive and healthy to a belief that you're dead that you can't refute. The most amazing part is when you ask them to take a pulse, they take the pulse and they say, yes, I have a pulse. Well, what do you conclude? Well, I conclude that dead people have a pulse.
I mean, it's almost funny, but in a way, it gets into deeper issues for you. It gets into the primitive part of the brain that may be really apart from reason. It's independent, it's involuntary, it's sort of like love and anger.
Correct.
And therefore not rational necessarily at all.
Not within our control and not really a thought even. In other words, love isn't a thought, it's a feeling. And the feeling of certainty is also, I mean, everybody who's had an aha realizes that something comes over them that happens to them. It isn't as though you can create an aha. I can have you read my book indefinitely, but unless something appeals to you about it at some visceral sensational level, you will not get, now I get it.
So even if I feel you're right, I'm not necessarily certain that you're right, or I shouldn't be, because my brain is telling me that.
That's right. Well, a good example is if you take 2 + 2 = 4, not only do you know that's correct, but at a gut level, it's correct. You feel it's correct. But if I tell you E = mc², you know it's correct because you studied it and maybe even used it in an exam in college, but I have no feeling that it's correct. I don't know. I mean, I know that people tell me it's correct, but it has no... So there's two aspects of the knowledge. There's the knowledge, and there's the knowledge about the knowledge. So with 2 + 2 = 4, you have the knowledge that is correct, and then you have the knowledge that the knowledge is correct. But in the E = mc², I have the knowledge that is correct because I can look it up. But I have no clue that it's correct at a gut level, so I don't have the sensation of the feeling of knowing.
Is this a little division of heart and head again, or something along those lines?
Well, you know, what really prompted me to write this book wasn't at all clear when I did. I first started this as a novel, and then I started as a memoir. Then I started as an Oliver Sacks type thing, and my agent kept saying, what is the guiding principle? What is the central issue that you're trying to write about? I said, I don't know. So I went back to a book I have on my bookshelf, which is from 1963, which is actually what prompted me to go into neurology, is there's a journal, Brain, in which they described in a succession of articles, one article is about deja vu. And I thought, what is deja vu? At that time, I'm only 22 years old. I don't know what deja vu is, but it's something that happens to you. You can't create a deja vu. You can't think deja vu. It is a sensation inside the head.
Well, Don DeLillo says it may be leaking out from the future or something like that.
Well, that's right. And, you know, so that this whole article really was a philosophical speculation on the various possibilities of what deja vu was, such as DeLillo talks about. I didn't know what it meant. But in the next article was an article about Dostoevsky experiencing a sensation of wonder and bliss and total experience of God that occurred as a part of an epileptic fit. And so he describes that he said he would give his whole life for that one moment because it was a moment of total clarity and understanding of the universe. And I thought, whoa, so here's an electrical sensation that creates a feeling of understanding, but he's not having a thought at the time. So there's a thought, a feeling about a thought, I understand, but there's no actual thought. He's not having he's not talking to you and thinking, what am I going to say next? But the next journal article was a guy, Wilder Penfield, and I think you're familiar with him, but he's the neurosurgeon at McGill and who mapped the brain for 25 years. Anyhow, he stimulated the brain and created a lot of these feelings in which people are conscious. They're having surgery under local anesthesia where you map the brain for epilepsy. And he stimulated feelings of familiarity, unfamiliarity, correctness, incorrectness, strange, bizarre, otherworldly, dread. And I thought, whoa, what are all these feelings? Where are they coming from? They're not in response to a thought. They are something that's arising de novo from the brain. But I didn't know what it meant at the time. But that's actually what prompted me to go into neurology, that this one journal article. And then some 30 years later, I went back to revisit these ideas, which I thought were going to be a novel, but
it's fascinating how it all dovetailed for you, yes, in so many ways. But, you know, it brings up questions about people who feel they've been abducted by aliens or people who have recovered memory about early sexual molestation and all of these kinds of things. And they, again, know that what they feel is absolutely valid. Or for that matter, people who have absolute belief in something, you know, fundamentalists or people who've had mystical experiences. You write about William James, in fact, and all that. And to some extent, you know, somebody would say, well, that's in a category. But I know, because I'm rational or I'm empirical. I mean, these are the arguments you hear. So I know that I'm right, and those people are going on much more on their viscera or on their emotions, their internal responses. But I'm using my, you know, cerebrality or something like that.
Right. But I think part of that comes from a misunderstanding of what's conscious versus unconscious thought. I mean, we tend to think of ourselves pretty much sliced off at what is conscious. In other words, if something occurs in the unconscious and you wake up in the morning with an idea, it sort of happened to you. No, it was part of you that did this, but we don't see that unconscious as being part of you. We see conscious as being us. So I see that with this idea of the sensation of knowing, we think it because it feels like knowledge. We assume it is knowledge. And that's actually, I think, the contribution of William James, because these people with the mystical experiences, he described it as being knowledge without knowledge or felt knowledge. And I thought that was a brilliant idea, though. Again, it took a long time for it to sink in what it meant. It meant that the brain has sensations that feel like knowledge. And familiarity is a good example. Familiarity is something that is very easily produced by stimulating the brain. But you can't generate a feeling of familiarity by thinking about it.
Talking with Robert Burton, who is the author of On Being Certain, Believing You Are Right Even When You're Not, and he's an MD, a neurologist. Thinking about James made me think of Richard Dawkins, whom you also mentioned at one point in the book. And, of course, he and Hitchens and Sam Harris now are all part of the zeitgeist of there is no God, and they're certain that there's no God. And their certainty is based on, well, in Dawkins' case, it's mostly sort of empirical Darwinian stuff. But, you know, this is a sense of I know it's right, and yet I feel it's right because I have all of this evidence to back me up. But, again, there's a part of the brain in the unconscious that goes towards certainty here that may not be all that trustworthy.
That's right. But, you know, to go back to Dawkins for a second, Darwin actually made the comment that people do not look at evidence objectively. And I'm 100% in favor of Darwin and evolution. Just don't get me wrong that I'm denigrating, because Dawkins, obviously, his ideas are very sound as ideas about evolution. But he doesn't recognize, I shouldn't say quite that way, I should say, in my humble opinion, he doesn't recognize that he's picking the evidence from the beginning about his feelings about faith out of an unconscious set of circumstances that includes his early childhood, genetic bias, predispositions, lots of things over which he has no control and he can't reach through introspection. So his point one...
Sound more like a psychiatrist than a neurologist, you know.
Well, you know, I might have gone into psychiatry. My father said he wouldn't help me pay for medical school if I did.
That's why you're a neurologist?
Well, you know, at that time they were both very closely allied. So, you know, we took boards in both of them.
What happened? There was a split or a schism, I'm sorry.
Right. I think what happened is science...
triumphed.
Right.
But you go back to... You bring in a lot about schizophrenia here, too, because understanding the brain and what you're talking about with certainty certainly brings light on schizophrenia.
Right. Well, you know, there's this whole concept now just emerging about pathologic certainty and uncertainty. I think one of the really good examples about how the feeling of knowing may be present without any event, such as in mystical experience, and may be absent despite absolute evidence, it would be the evidence of obsessive-compulsive disorder. And I don't know if you've seen people like this, but they turn off the gas, they go out of the house.
OCDC.
Yeah, and they go out at the door, and they say, well, how do I know I turned off the gas? They go back in the house, and they turn off the gas. They go out the door, and they do it several times. But they can't convince themselves that the gas is off. But they know, if you ask them, that they can see that the dial is at zero, and it can't be on, but they don't generate the feeling of knowing that the gas is off. Conversely, people with schizophrenia generate a feeling of knowing that they have that the delusion is real. And this is how you get into the UFOs, which would not be schizophrenia. It would be a piece of knowledge inconsistent with what science tells you. But if the feeling is strong enough, it is impossible to dispel.
Well, it's going to be even more difficult. You know, this guy in Denver, have you been following this story? He's going to be revealing supposedly a film of an extraterrestrial.
Really?
What tomorrow. Time should it be? It's in the next 24 hours. I don't know. We'll get word of it, I'm sure. You bring up Phineas Gage here back in Vermont, that kind of legendary accident that he had. And again, as a portal of understanding the brain, talk about that. Talk about the case, because a lot of people don't know about it.
Well, Phineas Gage was a worker on a railroad who had an accident where a big iron bar went through the portion of his frontal cortex, and he lived. I mean, they don't know exactly where it went, but they still have the skull, and they've been able to trace the pathway. And basically, he lost his executive function. His personality changed. He had a lot of what they call executive function deficits, personality, marital, bankruptcy, da-da-da, the usual stuff that you get when the frontal lobe disappears. And based upon, I think that's one of the first modern examples of where you look at what went, area of the brain went wrong and extrapolate what that brain, part of the brain actually does. And it's sort of the paradigm for which we look at modern neurology.
There's no pure reason, no such thing, you say. I mean, biologically, we're perhaps linked to reason, but no pure reason.
Correct.
All right, I got to go back and read some more Kant. We're talking to Robert Burton, and we're talking all about the brain and on being certain of the brain. What about Malcolm Gladwell, who tells us, you know, in the blink of an eye, you have an intuition, trust it, go with it, beats often serious kind of need for proof and evidence for proof?
Well, the first thing to speculate on, since all this book is speculation, is that most people now believe that 95%+, I don't know where that number comes from, but of our thoughts occur in the unconscious. You know, you think about something, you go to bed, and you wake up in the morning with the answer. Well, the unconscious is chugging away. Okay, so the first question is conscious thought any different than unconscious thought? Well, there'd be no reason to think that a computer works differently when you're looking at it than when you're not looking. I mean, like your car is a Prius in the garage, and then you back it out of the driveway and it turns into a Ferrari. I mean, it doesn't exactly make sense.
No, but they say if your unconscious turns conscious, you have some serious problems.
That's true. And so that's actually the what I suspect this feeling of knowing is if your brain's doing a myriad things and you're trying to figure, and the unconscious wants to only tell you the important things, it must make some calculation as to the likelihood that it's useful or correct or you're on the right track. For example, if you see me, you recognize me from last time I was here, but your brain went through a calculation and then you said, that's Burton. Okay, so, and that's high likelihood. So the likelihood is a feeling of knowing that it's me. Now, so unconscious thought plus the feeling of knowing also is what a gut feeling is. The gut feeling is, that's right. Now, if you take Gladwell's book, the opening opening chapter is about the Greek statue in which they bought it for $10 million at the Getty, and they thought it was great, and then a bunch of people came by and looked at it, and their first response was, oh, my God, it's a fake. Or as they talked about, repulsion and revulsion and various negative terms. And so as a result, there was some serious question as to whether the statue is a forgery or real.
But his thesis was all that authentication was completely blown out of the water by intuition.
Correct. So what he says is that in their initial revulsion, the quote is, they were absolutely right. Well, the interesting thing about it is they haven't yet decided whether it's a forgery or real. If you go on the Getty website and you look up the statue in question, it says either 530 BC or modern forgery. And it says, despite all of the opinions of all of the scientists and all of the art historians, we cannot decide. So it's okay for Gladwell to say that gut feeling should make you look to see if this is forgery or not, because these people have expertise, which is in fact what their unconscious is utilizing. But they didn't determine that it was a forgery. So when he says they're absolutely right, he's absolutely wrong.
What about when I say I'm absolutely right that I can't know or be certain about something? That in itself is certainly subject to scrutiny, isn't it?
Correct. So the paradox of this is I've tried to write a book in which I'm trying to convince people that you can't be absolutely certain that what I'm writing is correct.
Sounds like deconstruction theory.
It's postmodernism.
Post-structuralism.
Yeah. Yes, you're right. But there we are.
Well, here we are, and it makes you humble. You know, people think, I know myself or I know this other person. It's sort of beyond their ken to really know if you accept a lot of your hypotheses.
Well, you know, it's interesting that Gladwell's book actually stemmed from a really interesting book by Timothy Wilson called Strangers to Ourselves. And actually, he credits it in his website and in his book as being instrumental in writing the book. And what Timothy Wilson says, it's a Harvard Press book, taking what you presently know about modern neuroscience, it's impossible to have introspection down to the layers where you can know all of the ingredients that go into a thought. And that's really what this book is about, how thought starts prior to or beneath our conscious awareness.
Also is reassuring, though, in some ways, because as you point out, the need of knowing is something that we can, well, forego, because we need to take action. So we need to find out what alternative, even when there are so many alternatives that it makes choice, you know, you could become utterly paralyzed because of the alternative. So you say, in fact, getting back to Dawkins, it's good for evolution that
Correct.
We make these decisions.
Well, you know, if you think about a decision, that decision then says, maybe there are other possibilities and maybe that's right and maybe those possibilities. You need an endpoint. You need a switch that goes, stop with this recursive or infinite regression of constant doubt. You have to at some point go, that's enough. This is right. And it's particularly if you're trying to escape from a lion or something. Or
fish are cut bait, as we used to say.
Right. Yeah, so something's got to stop that Rumsfeld idea, we can't know what we don't know. So you have to have something separate from a thought that will do that.
Well, this is also something that you think may be genetically based, all these differences, all this need for certainty that we're talking about here. That is, there's a hidden layer in the brain.
Correct.
That really controls faith or reason.
That's right. And genetics might be an element, right? I don't think it's the whole picture, but it's certainly an element.
Talk about sham surgery, because you use that example in the
right.
book.
Well, sham surgery is the generation of the belief that you've had the surgery, and it has a real effect. In other words, so an inert operation, like the one I mentioned in the book, is about the knee surgery, which is really fascinating because they took a large group of like 180 patients with real degenerative osteoarthritis, the real thing, with major league X-ray changes, and the doctor who did the study really hadn't decided to have a placebo control because it never occurred to him that the effect of doing the surgery might be placebo. But they insisted at the institutional level that they have ethical guidelines. One of them had to be placebo. So he did sham surgery in one of these groups where they made incisions in the knee. They gave him general anesthesia, but they did not actually enter the knee or do anything. And the results were identical. So this is an example where the feeling of knowing, even if it's erroneous, has a positive evolutionary effect. In other words, that is a very strong placebo effect that is positive for the person, even though it's based upon a deception.
Well, you know, as a boy, I used to watch faith healers. And I said
yeah?
to myself, you know, you see people throw away crutches and everything, and they've been on them for years in some instances, you know, and they had terrible problems, crippling problems, and pain, you know, that was acute and so forth. Suddenly they felt they were touched by Jesus or whatever it was, and as a result, gone.
Correct.
Yeah, I mean, it does kind of align with a lot of what you're saying here.
I saw a lady who went to Catherine Kuhlman in Southern California. I don't know if you remember, she was one of those tent revivalists in the 60s and 70s. And this woman had a stroke, and she made a full and complete recovery. Only in retrospect did I have to ask myself, had I misdiagnosed her in the first place? But I couldn't tell because it was too late now because she was fine.
Well, in fact, at one point you say, maybe instead of saying I know, you should say I believe. And then someone took you at the task for that and said, if you say I believe, it sounds too much like faith or
that's right.
Suggest faith.
There should be some word that says somebody suggested I've been thinking about or in my opinion as opposed to I know. In other words, there has to be something that suggests that there's room for error.
That's good for broadcasters in my opinion because, I mean, I'm talking about, you know, like in commercial broadcasting where they're often vulnerable for libel or something like that. They say in my opinion and that kind of gets them off
the hook.
Oh, that's
great. I remember that.
Talking to Robert Burton on Being Certain is his book, Believing You Are Right Even When You're Not, and you are welcome to join us. In fact, we'd like to hear from you if you have some questions or comments about what you've heard so far. I want to talk about this subject. If you're certain about what you know and you want to let us know that you're certain about what you know, or feel free to join the program. Our toll-free number, 866-733-6786. Lines are open and available to you, and you can join us whether you're listening to us on radio, internet, or a Sirius satellite. Again, it's toll-free for your calls, 866-733-6786, or you can send us an email, and our email address here is simply forum@kqed.org. And when we return, we'll have your calls and emails. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. We're talking with neurologist Robert A. Burton, who has written a new book called On Being Certain, Believing You Are Right Even When You're Not. It has on the cover, in fact, a glass that's half full that's right side up and a glass that's half full that's upside down. Clever.
It
Where'd
is.
That come from?
Beats me, but they did a good job.
Credited to the publisher. We're going to go to your calls, and we'll go first to Jazz in Redwood City. Morning.
Good morning. How are you?
Okay.
I was hoping the speaker could speak to...
I'm not certain I'm okay, but I'll say for the record now that I am. Yeah, go ahead, I'm sorry.
Yes, what he feels is the interplay between sudden becoming as a breakdown from memory or episodic memory being a function of recall and a function of a reconstructive process. And if he thinks certainty happens, or the interplay between that and how he thinks certainty, whether he thinks certainty is being this process, it's hijacking one or the other or what.
I think we're trying to get the essence of the question there. Can you state it a little more succinctly or directly?
Well, when you have recall an episodic memory, we usually think we're just accessing knowledge that is there in our brain. But in fact, I think there's a fair amount of evidence that there's a reconstructive process to it.
There's really asking about the unreliability of memory, and indeed it is unreliable for the most part, isn't it?
Right. When actually, if you think about the Challenger study. The original memory was laid down on the morning that the shuttle blew up. And then these people go on and have several more years of experience. And that experience will modify that memory. And as that experience is modified, it will also modify their sense of what is correct. So I know, for example, when I was in grammar school, they had these little tiny benches that you sat on. Then I went back and visited the grammar school as an adult. Those benches seemed different size. Now, my perception of those bench height is going to be different from point A, when I was a little kid, where I sat on and there were my whole leg would go down, to where I was, you know, they're a little tiny when I'm an adult. Now, that memory has to change. Not only will it change, but so will the knowledge of the size of the bench.
In fact, memory, well, I remember, for example, you're telling me years ago that when you were last on here that men and women were asked about the first time they met, and there was a really distinct gender difference.
That's right. I think the story I told you was about, if I remember correctly, was about these two people described the first time they met, and they said they met in an airport waiting room, waiting for a flight, and the man described it as that airport waiting room was empty, and this woman came over and sat next to him, and it went from there, and the woman described it as it was totally crowded, and that was the only seat available was right next to him, and that she was forced to sit next to him, and then their relationship started from there. And they both swore that it was correct. They asked people in an audience, 100% of the people voted for the woman.
And generally, different hormones probably affect the memories, endocrinologically, one could assume. But memory, I always thought, I remember reading something by the novelist Jerzy Kosinski who said, memory accommodates feelings, and feelings accommodate memory. Would you buy that?
Memories, yes, I think that's true. I think that you have to ask yourself, if you have a feeling of happiness towards a particular event, they're so-called mood-dependent memory retrieval. So you'll remember certain aspects of a memory when you're in a good mood. You're in a bad mood, you'll remember other things. For example, I'm in a good mood today, so I can't think of people that I don't like, why I don't like them. On another day, when I'm in a bad mood, I might remember everything they ever did to me. So there is mood-dependent memory retrieval, which again goes back to hormones and et cetera. So yes, I think that memory is in fact served by sensation, and if you include sensation as mood.
So how we reconstruct our memories.
Yes. Yeah. And Daniel Schachter's written about this extensively.
Yeah, he's been on a forum.
Right.
Ryan, you're on. Good morning.
Hi. I was recently reading a Bertrand Russell essay called Mysticism and Logic, and he talks a lot about humans as choice-making beings. And the guest was talking about that sort of dualism between action and thought. And Bertrand Russell talks about how knowledge is a spectrum between intuition and logic, and humans have an impulse to go to one side. And I was wondering if your guest had an opinion on where on the spectrum between logic and intuition is knowledge best understood? Where should one be?
I don't know where one should be, because you're really asking different questions. For example, if I want to write a novel, I will have to ask a question that will go into my unconscious, and it might take years to percolate for me to figure out what it is I want to write about. You can't really use logic to decide whether this is good or bad until it's taken shape in your mind, Once it's, so I look upon the unconscious as the mind in the edit off mode.
Freud called it the horse and buggy that drives you or something along those
Correct.
Lines.
Correct, you know? Exactly. And I look upon consciousness and therefore logic is edit on mode. They're really different ways of thinking. I think you need to accommodate both somehow, but I don't know what the right combination is.
I guess it depends on what you're trying to do.
That's right. If it's a short-term thing like trying to figure out how to get over here to the studio, I think it's logic might prevail.
How'd you do on that score?
It took me an extra half an hour because I wasn't certain.
Ryan, thank you for the call. We always get a navigational system, and that'll work, one presumes. Always go to technology. Rob, hi. You're on. Good morning.
Hi. I wanted to get your opinion on my 9-year-old. So she seems to have a very old soul. She seems to be very mature. And we're people of faith, but we're not overly zealot about anything. And the other day, we're doing a Bible study, and she turns to me and just out of the blue says, "I believe in spite of what my mind tells me." And I just looked at her, and I just said, what did you say? What do you mean? And she looked at me, and she says, "I believe in spite of what my mind tells me." What's going on with her level of certainty? What's going on in her mind when she's telling me something like that?
You sure she hasn't watched some recent TV episodes or something along those lines?
No.
Okay.
This is, you know, everybody thinks that their kid is special, and everybody has that opinion about their own children. We have 5, and this one in particular seems to be different than the rest.
Well, let's find out what Dr. Burton has to say.
What you're actually describing is that she has a feeling of faith, which I would describe as being a mental sensation that your brain generates, that is in contrast to what her logic is telling you. And I will tell you that I have a friend who's one of the heads of molecular biology at Berkeley, and he's told me the exact same thing. He said, "My whole life has been a struggle against what I know to be true and the urge to have faith." He says, "I can't reconcile them, so I just fight against it." And I suspect what you're seeing is a separation between your daughter's understanding of what religion might be about and an intrinsic desire or feeling of knowing that there is something more. And I that's to be commended, because she's actually recognizing the two modes of faith, the one that is sort of visceral gut that some people have and others don't have, and the other, which is sort of an intellectual process that leads to religion and iconography and that kind of thing. So I kind of like what your daughter said.
Tina, you're on with us. Morning.
Hi. I'm just wondering, I haven't heard the name of Carl Jung come up, and I'm curious if you have had much contact, because you're really talking about a lot of the same areas, especially I think of him saying, "We don't have a thought has us." And that he broke with Freud, not because Freud was wrong, but because he stopped short in trying to reduce everything to conscious memories.
I remember that Jung was absolutely certain about astrology, for starters, here.
He actually left a lot of room for uncertainty. And, in fact, my favorite quote is from Einstein, talking about we must proceed with holy curiosity, the capacity to tolerate uncertainty while searching for constructive possibilities. And I feel that's where Jung was.
Two things. First of all, my favorite quote from Einstein is that the difference between genius and stupidity is that genius has its limits. But as far as Jung goes, I think he actually says in one of his writings that he thinks the collective unconscious actually has a genetic component. And I think by that, he's now with modern science, you might imply that there is a certain universality or along a spectrum of faith versus no faith, belief versus no belief, that actually comes in partly out of your genes.
That's a troubling assumption, though. I mean, for example, I don't know if you know a work of Eugene O'Neill's called The Emperor Jones, but
Correct.
He takes that and he says, you know, he goes back to a black man in America having a racial history of being on
Right.
a slavery block and all of, you know, those kinds of things, that somehow that's embedded in the genes. And I think many people would, you know, feel extremely uncomfortable with that notion. In the collective unconscious, in other words.
What I meant was that there are certain traits that are common to all of us.
Universal, human, yeah.
Yeah, that's what I didn't mean, yeah. Yeah, right. And I've seen Emperor Jones, done by Willem Dafoe, was great. I'm not sure I understand that O'Neill was right about that. I don't. So
well, that was how O'Neill read Jung. We don't need to get into that. Yeah. Let me get into instead some emails here, including one on Dawkins. This is Sean who says, Dawkins states he is not absolutely 100% certain there is no God, just like he can't state with 100% certainty that there are no fairies. Based on the evidence, however, he is betting against it. Atheism is a lot closer to reason than theism. Dawkins even states he rates himself a 6 on a scale of 7 in terms of being certain. He gives room for error, however unlikely it may be. Here's a listener who says, Wittgenstein, I can't possibly know this hand is in front of my face.
I pass. Wittgenstein's story that I like best is the one I put in the book about...
Yeah, there is a story here. Yeah,
yeah, about right versus right. About the man who goes into the tailor shop and wants to get his clothes made, and the tailor makes all the measurements. They bring... A week later, comes back, and the man says, gee, my suit doesn't fit right. He says, well, the tailor measures it again, and it measures exactly the way he wanted it. And he says, yes, it may be right, but it's not right. And I that's my Wittgenstein quote on this feeling of knowing.
And here's Noel, who says, this discussion makes me wonder about members of the Bush administration, especially regarding weapons of mass destruction. We can't really know what they were really thinking, but it seems Bush really knew WMDs were in Iraq.
Yeah, I think there was something this morning on self-deception. I wouldn't be surprised that he's made the quote, America wants certainty in the White House.
I mean, yeah, he said that on a number of occasions. And there were words to that effect. Yeah.
Right, and I suspect that in his mind, certainty is an attribute. It's a quality to be admired.
We'll go to Michael next. Michael, you're on. Good morning.
Yes. Boy, this kind of dovetails with the last email you just talked about. My question is, given the thesis of your book, how can we, as citizens of this country in the middle of a political year here, begin to believe what comes out of politicians' mouths, given the subjective nature of thought and reason and everything that's that you're talking about here? How can we kind of judge for ourselves who's telling the truth?
I don't have an answer, or I would have written it down, but I have a suggestion, and most people will present their point of view, and then the other side will present their point of view. What I'd like in a candidate would be to present both sides and with the arguments for both sides, because then it would tell me that he's considered both sides, and then he could make his best reasoning for both sides, which means he would have to gather evidence for the things he didn't believe in. So to me, I would like to see, rather than debates, I would like to see each candidate debate himself.
Well, you read my book, so you know that right. I write about, you know, seeing two sides, and that can be a blessing or a curse. But it can also lead you to, well, what people might call wishy-washiness. You know, I'm too gray. I don't see black and white. And here's a president of the United States who says, I see black and white, and certainty is a strength. And so you kind of vacillate between what you think is a strength, maybe, and taking that decisive position as opposed to what may be a weakness and seeing too many grays.
Well, you know, in medicine, you never have all the information. So at the end of the day, you have to take some action. You make a decision. You make a diagnosis. You make a treatment plan. But prior to that, you should weigh the evidence from both sides or all sides of whatever the issue is. So actually, you can't do this interminably. You can't stand there for 20 years saying, I can't make up my mind.
No, you're Hamlet forever. Yeah.
Right, but you can at least say, I have considered the following, A, B, C, and D, and this is why, after considering these, I choose A, and that's what we'll act on. So it's a pause, or maybe a slowing down of the process.
But the irony is, in politics, politicians are given deficits for being flip-floppers,
right.
As if that's a bad thing, when in many cases they've just looked at it from another perspective and decided that makes more sense presently, maybe ephemerally, but I'll go on and move forward on that.
Well, there was this... The person who coined the phrase moral majority and was interviewed, I think it was by Terry Gross, actually, was asked how it was that the Republicans did so much better on talk radio than the Democrats. And he said, well, it's obvious. He says, Democrats believe in nuance. and really, the fact of the matter, somehow we have to come to understand that nuance and some ambiguity is inherent in decision-making.
Does this thesis of yours, as we're talking about it, bring up the idea of solipsism at all, the idea that there's no truth beyond the self or the subjective perceptions of the self or selves, multiple selves of oneself?
Well, it does in the sense, yes and no. It does in the sense that each of us starts from a different point of view, and there isn't any single line of reasoning that we all share, because we start with all of our genetic factors, all of our biologic, early childhood, pre-verbal factors that influence how we think about life. And we then choose the evidence based upon a starting point which is not ground zero. It's already a fair amount of information has been laid down in your brain the first couple of years. Yours will be different than mine. We may have a lot of overlap because of common backgrounds. We may have differences. So, yes, there's solipsism in the sense of it starts from the self, but it has to incorporate more than just yourself if it's going to be a useful opinion.
Well, a listener mentioned Bertrand Russell before, and I'm reminded of one of his so-called unpopular essays where he says there's no way to know that the world, the universe, the cosmos, didn't come into being like a nanosecond ago with all of our memories and everything intact. That is to say, the past may not exist. The past may be just illusory.
Right. It's like, are we asleep or are we awake? And all the rest.
Yeah, all those kind of interesting college dorm discussions. Anyway, here's Ed in Berkeley who says, can you speak to the qualities of the brain sensation of certainty's opposite, that is uncertainty? Former poet laureate Bob Haas paraphrased Coleridge on the life of being a poet as involving, quote, intellectual doubt and emotional terror.
I think that's true. And I think when I say certainty, I think it's a spectrum. Some people are naturally doubters and nothing feels as though it's certain. I happen to fall in that category. In other words, I've lived a life in which I'm happy to think this is the best probability, the highest likelihood, practice medicine that way, but never with that gut feeling, that's it. Very rarely have I had it. Other people get it all the time. So I suspect that certainty versus uncertainty is a spectrum of the...
Maybe brain differences again?
Yeah, I think so. You know, if you believe in the unconscious as generating an enormous amount of information, my suspicion is that the feeling of certainty is the calculation of likelihood of correctness as that sends things up into consciousness. Well, some people might experience it as, that's interesting. Other people might experience it as, wow, that's absolutely correct. So the feeling they get is the same thing as two people experiencing any sensation, whether it's pain or love, or some people seem rather phlegmatic and others are wildly excitable. I suspect that's the way we're built.
Could be set points. A lot of that could be set points.
That's a good way to look at it.
As a young man, I read Cardinal Newman, who used to talk about the difference between emotional assent and notional and emotional assents. And they are never the twain, sometimes the twain, depending on how your brain's constructed. Here's Sasha, who says, your guest mentioned how the equation E equals MC squared is known to be true, but there's no feeling that it's true. If that's the case, then how would someone who actually formulates a seemingly abstract equation like that feel about it? When we see that equation, we don't think of the sequence of logical progressions that led to it, but someone like Einstein is probably well aware of all this. Would this equation feel true to Einstein?
Correct. That's actually what I was getting at, is that for each of us, the experience of something that we know to be true will be different. Some of us will feel it's true in addition to knowing it's true, others will not.
And here's a listener, Matt, who says, as a mediator, I occasionally find that one of the parties at the table exhibits what can be described as abusive behavior. I've observed positional behavior that could be described as desperate. In a number of cases, all the person had to do was say something along the lines of, you're right, I'm sorry, and the issue would be over. Instead, they resort to a massive display of tactics, including blaming, distracting, manipulation, manipulating or distorting facts, aggressive verbal takeover of conversation, etc. There's something to be said here, I think, just for the notion that it isn't always important to say I'm right and to insist on I'm right and, you know, to almost foment one's own feeling of certainty about rightness.
It's really hard to imagine where I'm right as opposed to there's a very high likelihood I'm right serves an additional purpose. Because whatever additional, in other words, in this evolution versus intelligent design controversy, and obviously I'm totally for evolution, it's in that little one in a million chance that evolution could be modified to some slight degree that people aren't willing to give that up, including myself. But by not giving it up, you're also acknowledging that we can absolutely know the other side can be correct. And if you could step back just a fraction, you're forced to say, well, if I could be wrong, even if it's the chance of one in a zillion, then the other side should be able, ideally, I mean, if we all live in an ideal world, say, well, then maybe I could be wrong. So you're right. The idea that I know carries with it a real bludgeon or weapon-like phenomenon.
Like I said, it's humbling. And it's, you know, I mean, I've heard arguments where people will say, I feel that you did this to me or that you acted in such a way to me, and I know that that's true because I feel it. And the other person, I don't know what you're talking about. What are you talking about? There's such a wide disparity there that what you have to say sometimes, you have to concede the fact that you're talking about completely different perceptions, utterly different.
And you start from different positions. For example, I was in the airport the other day, and I saw a professional basketball team or whatever, and they're like 7 feet tall, and I thought, whoa, the world will look different if you were 7 feet tall than 6 feet tall. You can't possibly expect us to see the world the same way, and that's something just totally physical.
And certainly true. I think we can be relatively certain about that the world looks different if you're taller.
Oh, yeah.
Let me go to more of our callers, and we go next to Peter in Fairfax. Morning.
Good morning. I'm actually tall. I'm 6'5", but I'm also the violence prevention manager for the Inside Prison Project in San Quentin Prison. And one of the things that we really understand about violence right now is at the moment of violence, everybody believes that they need to do the violence to survive, to live, that they have a moment where they're going to die if they don't do it, whether it's for respect or whether it's for the patriarchy or whatever the belief system is below it. And I wonder if you could talk about that.
Yeah, actually, my suspicion is that the initial trigger for violence is almost reflexive. In other words, the same way as fear is. And I will say that I studied with a neurophysiologist years ago, Ben Libet, who wrote a book called Mind Time. And he makes the point that lots of our decisions, initial decisions, are made in the unconscious and are beyond our control. But consciously, we can veto acting on them. So rather than try to say, don't get angry, you say, you got angry. But that may be inappropriate. In other words, you look at what happened first rather than trying to control the basic impulse. For example, if I get nervous coming on your radio show, for example, and I get nervous, there's no point in saying to me, relax. You might say, well, you shouldn't be nervous. You get nervous, that's your response, relax. But relax about the thought, not about the feeling that first generates. So with violence, I suspect that violence in part is reflexive.
Which gives a lot of power to the notion of free will being cognitively based.
And so what Ben Libet told me years ago, and I was beginning to sink in, is he says we have veto power over our unconscious decisions.
Hmm. So with Scott McKellen coming out with this book about George Bush and his decision to go to war with Iraq, can you relate that to the decision too?
Right. Supposing I were coaching George Bush on the couch, I might say to him, George, I know that you tend to make absolute decisions, and that's your reflexive reaction. Now, some of those aren't going to be right because they're coming out of the unconscious and only can know through more deliberate rumination.
So, maybe Maureen Dowd is right. He went to Iraq because of his father.
Well, you know, I wouldn't be surprised that if nobody corrected him, which I understand a lot of people are afraid to do, that his initial response would just go unchecked. So he has to somehow understand, well, wait a minute. Well, let's look at that. You can't change the initial response, I don't think, very easily. That's the problem with psychiatry.
Let me thank the caller. Here's John in Oakland who says, I want to ask about the relationship between memory and smell. I studied abroad in Germany for close to a year, and there are certain smells, such as a specific laundry soap, that bring back vivid memories of Germany. Not the exciting stuff I did and saw, but rather the everyday things, like the basement where I did laundry, or biking down a street, or walking to a class. Why is smell so related to memory?
I think it's number one in terms of the likelihood of evoking profound memories, and perhaps this is related to the development, you know, the sort of primitive brain.
But the olfactory is tied into that.
Yeah, absolutely. So that it is the number one evocator of old memories. I don't know the details as to why, though.
Do you believe that Proust was right, that there are voluntary memories and involuntary memories? I mean, there are memories that we control, but memories that we simply can't control, that invade us and come to us, maybe even uninvited, unwanted, and whatever.
Yes. So if you think about it, basically you have the unconscious delivering memories according to their purposes, which is whatever, and you have yourself trying to recall. And a a good example is if you go to bed trying to think of a name, you may not remember it. The unconscious may deliver it to you. On the other hand, you may remember a lot of names that were irrelevant. So, yes, they are.
But it's that phenomenon. You write about it. The tip of my tongue, you know, I know this.
Right.
And then suddenly it comes at you from nowhere after you simply can't think of it.
Correct.
I got time for maybe another quick email here. Robert says, there's been a woman in the media recently, I think she was interviewed on Talk of the Nation last week, who apparently does not forget, meaning that she seems to remember in vivid detail every moment of her life. Given the changeability of memory for most people and the ability to implant or alter memories, I wonder how she can be so certain. Is she an interesting test case or boundary condition for investigating certainty?
I actually read about her. She's the lady who remembers virtually everything and every date. I mean, some people think that it's a true memory savant phenomenon. Other people believe that she spent all of her days obsessing about memory and that she has a form of OCD. I actually don't know until I would, you know, you'd have to sit down.
Could be both.
Yes. Yes, it could be.
Well, this is an enjoyable read and always a pleasure to have you with us. Bob Burton's new book, Robert Burton, is On Being Certain, Believing You Are Right Even When You're Not. Thank you so much for being with us on
Thanks,
Forum.
Michael.
And we're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11. An hour is repeated, 10 to 11 in the evening. We do appreciate your being listeners of Forum and hope you will continue to be. And news and Talk of the Nation, of course, coming up next. Want to again welcome our new producer, well, reinstatement rights, producer Judy Campbell. Forum's produced by Kevin Guillory and Tina Lauerberg. Our senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our interns are Rania Ahmed, Nicole Beckley, Susan Britton, Julie Barsamian, and Kevin Lee. Our engineer is Danny Bringer, and Forum's executive producer is Raul Ramirez. Just remind you that you can let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum by emailing us, forum@kqed.org, or calling our listener call-in response line at 415-553-3300. Thanks to you all again, and for all of us here at KQED, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Claude and Louise Rosenberg Jr. Family Foundation.